I then learned that the Valley of Mystery was the headquarters of a powerful occult fraternity of which Narabu was a member. Dolma had never visited it. "Are you interested in such things?" he asked me bluntly, since I maintained a certain reserve every time he began to go more fully into the matter. "Yes," I answered, "I am interested in all spiritual matters, but I never join any sect or association whatsoever." "Why?" he asked. "Because I wish to maintain absolute independence," I answered. "In our fraternity, the freedom of the members, power on earth. But our members obey him voluntarily." "Why is it called the Valley of Mystery?" I asked. "This is the name given to it by the multitude," he answered. "No one except our members and occasional guests are admitted to the valley, and the population does not know much about it, and people who live in the same district even abstain from talking about it. That is why it is commonly called the Valley of Mystery." "How about the guests who occasionally visit the valley?" I asked. "By whom are they invited?" "The members who hold a somewhat higher position in the occult hierarchy may invite guests, but then they are entirely and personally responsible for them." "I happen to be such a member," stated Naobu. "What obligations must a guest enter into before he is allowed to visit the valley?" I asked him. "None at all. Until he joins the fraternity, he is under no obligation at all. But what qualifies a man to be chosen as such a guest?" "A sincere and wholehearted desire for salvation," said Naobu. "Do you think I am such a man?" "I think you are. If you care to come, I shall invite you on my own responsibility." Then and there he fetched a rough sketch map of Tibet. "The only obligation for you," he said, while he put the map on the carpet before us, "is an undertaking that you will not reveal its exact location." I promised this, and he immediately showed me on the map the location of the valley. "I propose that you should leave early tomorrow morning. I shall give instructions to one of my servants to accompany you until the evening so that you may get away from this district, where all strangers are regarded with some suspicion. I shall also give you a letter stating that you are a member of my household. If you are annoyed by officials or lamas, show them the letter." Naobu drank the contents of another cup of tea. During the last half hour he had gulped down the contents of one cup after another at the rate of one cup every 5 minutes. And good-sized cups they were too. He added sugar every time. Only very rich Tibetans can afford such a thing. Since sugar is expensive in comparison with the income of the Tibetan multitude, the Tibetans in the humble walks of life do not add sugar to their tea. Even on the rare occasions when they do not mix it with butter and barley meal, they do not dissolve the sugar in the tea but merely touch it from time to time with the tip of their tongue, washing down the liquid at intervals. "This is the 9th cup since you came here," observed Naobu. "Has it ever occurred to you that 9 is a very auspicious number?" "I have studied the various occult philosophies," I answered, "and have my own views on numerology which are the result of much independent thinking. I do not hold the view that 9 is an auspicious number." "Why?" "I think man ought not to carry numerological speculations beyond the figure 5, I answered. "Why that?" 5 is the number of man. The higher numbers lead to complication and perdition, the smaller ones to God. But surely the number 9 exists. "It does, because the conventional system of counting runs up to 9, and then 10 quite arbitrarily becomes the higher unit. We could just as well adopt a system in which we should have only 4 figures, namely 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 being equivalent to the higher unit. Then 9 would not exist, nor would 6, 7 and 8, which in my opinion arithmosophically are all numbers of complication, entanglement, and seduction." "What an original idea!" exclaimed Naobu. "I have studied numerology footnote for several years. Its occult bearing is enormous. Figures have an occult connection with abstract notions with which we correlate them. In this way figures can be made a kind of medium between the divine and man." "Numerology is a highly double-edged affair," I observed, "although it looks quite harmless." "Suppose we get down to concrete numerological notions," said Naobu. Although you seem to be reluctant to indulge in numerological abstractions beyond the figure 5, perhaps you will have no objection to our taking up 1, 2, 3, 4 and 5. Take 1. 1 is the number of oneness, the number of non-manifested divinity. I think you must agree to this. Yes, I observed, I do. If we imagine a point in space, it is a mere abstraction, for a point really is immaterial. So 1 is the number of undivided abstract existence. I am surprised that you introduce geometrical notions into the field of numerology. It is a very original idea, observed Naobu. Now let us take footnote. The philosophy of abstract figures. F. The following conversation on numerology has a connection with some of the observations made by the author in the mysterious underground Kti of the initiates described later in the book. The figure 2. It represents the contrast between spirit and matter. I profoundly disagree with you here, I said. Do you deny that 2 is the number of contrasts? Asked Naobu, greatly surprised. I agree that 2 is the number of contrasts, I answered, but not the contrast you have just mentioned. If we take 2 points in space, they determine the position of a straight line, which also is immaterial. But it remains to be seen what abstract contrast is reflected by the figure 2. You say it is the one between spirit and matter. In my opinion, you are wrong. Spirit is an abstraction, but matter is not. So the abstract line represented by figure 2, which connects 2 points, each of which is immaterial, really is the contrast between 2 different kinds of spirit and not between spirit and matter. Naobu remained silent for a while and then he said, you seem to be right, but this never occurred to me. More and more I feel how useful you would be to us in the secret city in the Valley of Mystery. For the first time he had mentioned a secret city. There must be 2 altogether different types of spirituality which are diametrically opposed to each other, I continued. That, in my opinion, is the numerological significance of the figure 2. We then discussed 3 and 4, and agreed that 3 was the dynamic number par excellence and 4 the number of matter. 3 points scattered in space determine the position of a triangle, I observed. But only 4 abstract points lay down the outline of a geometrical form having corporeal existence. With 3 therefore we leave the realm of the abstract and with 4 we enter the domain of the concrete. 4 is the number of the visible universe, the number of matter. We have not yet reached the dangerous figures, said Naobu smilingly. If we imagine 5 points scattered in space, I went on, and call them A, B, C, D and E, we may envisage A, B, C and D only and obtain a geometrical form, but we may also link up A, B, C and E, and obtain another geometrical form. In fact, we can obtain 5 different combinations, namely, A, B, C, D, abs, abd, act and B, C, D, E. 5 therefore represents the interpenetration of 5 different spaces. With 5 the creature has reached the very limits of its existence. 5 is the number of the creature and the number of manifested life which seems to exist simultaneously on 5 planes. Man lives, if I may say so, in 5 different realms, viz., the physical one and those of sensation, feeling, intelligence, and will. These are 5 realms which interpenetrate each other. If you imagine 6 points scattered in space, I went on. A synthetical geometrical conception of the various connections between the 6 points is obviously beyond the reach of man. As I said before, the figures exceeding 5 viewed numerologically have a dissociating effect on the personality of man. They are numbers of perdition. Naobu was in deep thought. Yo, you have taught me much during these few minutes, he observed after a while. It is good sometimes to hear about conceptions which are very different from the ones to which we are accustomed. By the way, can you give me a short definition of what matter really is? Matter, I replied, may be regarded as the battleground on which 2 different types of spirituality fight each other. That is where we disagree again, observed Naobu. I always thought that there was only 1 type of spirituality. I think this is a question to be decided by experience rather than by argument, I said. We shall discuss this further in the secret city, observed Naobu. For the second time he had hinted at the existence of a secret city. He proceeded to show me the various parts of his house. He also had a large garden which must have been quite an extraordinary thing in the district, since parks and gardens are but seldom to be found in Tibet outside the Lhasa district. He was very friendly, and said that he greatly appreciated my company. I felt that he was absolutely sincere, and that he did not act in any way. A servant came up to him announcing two visitors of rank, and went away to show them into a kind of elegantly furnished reception room. It will perhaps be better for you not to talk to them, observed Naobu. I suggest that you wait for me here, and if my absence becomes lengthy you may go up to my study, to the library, or to the garden. His Excellency smiled and went to the reception room. A high Tibetan official passed me a few seconds later, led by a servant and accompanied by a Tibetan officer. When he saw my cheap chupa footnote, he eyed me with obvious contempt, as he did not know, of course, that one was Naobu's guest. But when the door of the reception room was opened by another servant, his attitude of haughty arrogance suddenly gave way to toad-like obsequiousness as he greeted Naobu, who had come to the threshold to meet him. When the visitors had left, Naobu joined me immediately, and soon afterwards a substantial meal was served, including such delicacies as potatoes, rice and apples, which are practically never eaten by the Tibetan multitude because they are much too expensive. Again and again another servant brought a silver dish containing tepid water for washing our fingers. After dinner we went to the library. Although most books were Tibetan, of course, there were quite a few English books in it, including fairly recent works on occultism and political and sociological questions. Is there also a library in the Valley of Mystery? I asked him. Yes, he replied, but it is only accessible to the members of the fraternity. You are going there as my guest on my full and personal responsibility, but guests are not allowed to visit the library of the Forbidden City unless they obtain special footnote. Gown. Permission which only the chief of the occult hierarchy, whom we reverently call the Prince of Light, can grant. Naobu drew a sketch and then handed it to me, saying, this sketch shows you the best way to reach the valley. Will you permit me to add some money for your expenses during the journey? He took a bundle of new Tibetan banknotes footnote, and a handful of silver coins out of a drawer. No, I said, it is very kind of you, but I travel alone and meet brigands from time to time. It is of no use for me to take so much money along, as it would almost certainly be taken away on the next occasion I meet them. I still have some coins which are carefully hidden in my shoes. I cannot take more. I am sorry, said Naobu, but I notice your shoes are no longer in good condition. If you permit me to loan you a new and comfortable pair of leather shoes and a new chupa, I should be very, very pleased. I then spent the larger part of the afternoon in the library. After the substantial evening meal served by three servants and another walk in the garden, Naobu led me to one of the guest rooms situated on the first floor. I then spent a few hours in repairing my equipment and tried to fall asleep a couple of hours after sunset, which is a very difficult matter. Footnote. For about 10 years past, the Tibetan government has issued banknotes which, however, are currency only in the less isolated districts of the country. In the inhabited part of Tibet, since most Tibetans show just as little consideration for people who may want to fall asleep as the inhabitants of some parts of the continent of Europe. Since Naobu's Tsong was surrounded by many Tibetan houses, the various noises went on unabated until late at night. At 5 o'clock in the morning, kind-hearted and hospitable Naobu rose personally to see to it that I was properly attended to by the servants, and after an early breakfast taken in the company of my host, I left his Tsong accompanied by one of his trusted servants, who had instructions to accompany me until I had left the inhabited district. Before I left, Naobu told me that he would leave his house for the Valley of Mystery on horseback a day or two later, and he handed me a letter of introduction. He added that he had already sent a message announcing my arrival to the City of the Initiates by a messenger on horseback, who had left the Tsong the previous day. After Nabu's servant had left me to return to the Tsong of his master, I had only one experience worth recording before I reached the Valley of Mystery. The following day I came across a group of Tibetan ascetics who believed that it was possible to attain spiritual results by fasting and other exercises having a direct influence on the body. Their belief was briefly as follows: man is both spirit and matter. Spirit is immanent. It is immovable and divine by its very essence. So all man has to do is to attend to the channel through which spirit manifests itself, namely his body, and thus the flow of spirit will pass through it without hindrance and man will become automatically spiritualized. One these and Nas ascetics fasted, and during the course of their fast and other physical exercises, destined to keep their bodies absolutely pure, they were, of course, intensely conscious of their bodies. Their exercises really seemed to amount to a strange kind of dissociation of man's consciousness by concentrating all his awareness into his body. It was a most unusual experience to meet people in Tibet who took so great care of their bodies. Painstaking care for them seemed to be a kind of fixed idea with this special type of ascetics. They considered butter as not pure enough for cleaning their bodies, footnote, and replaced it by mustard and oil, the price of which is much more than the Tibetan multitude can afford. If someone concentrates his whole attention on his body and in doing so uses various choice things the price of which is exorbitant, it is small wonder that he is more selfish in his everyday life than the ordinary individual who does not turn the care of his body into a religion. These Nandas ascetics are not very numerous, and provide footnote. The usual way of cleaning one's body in Tibet is by rubbing it with a pat of butter. Many a reader will no doubt smile at this, but the author has found that butter really has an excellent cleaning effect on the body. Soap has been used in the West only during the last few centuries, and the ancient Romans, who were very clean people, since the number of Roman public baths was large, used oil for cleaning their bodies. Also mustard and egg yolk seem to have a remarkably strong cleansing effect on the human body. A strange contrast to the Tibetan multitude, who entirely neglect their bodies. From time to time these ascetics fast during considerable periods, but why do these people fast? Because they want to be spiritual, happy and healthy, and because they expect that they will be able greatly to prolong their lives by taking good care of their bodies. I had to think of a Western health apostle whom I happen to know. He is about 60 years of age now and has taken the greatest care of his kidneys for 40 years by carefully avoiding food which would not be good for them. He now has a serious kidney disease which seems to have been brought about by his continual fear for his kidneys. Surely spirituality cannot be attained by physical practices. On the other hand, it is just as foolish to neglect one's body. I thought that these Nandas ascetics badly needed a good dose of common sense. Chapter 4: The Underground City of the Initiates. I knew from Nabu that the City of the Initiates was an important center situated in the Valley of Mystery at a distance of about 20 miles from the nearest village. I wondered again and again how a whole city could keep unwelcome visitors and the curious multitude away, all the more so as Nabu had told me that the city was not surrounded by walls or ditches and that it was not even guarded, an ordinary Tibetan monastery being infinitely better protected than the city. In one of the smaller side valleys of the Sangpa Valley I could not get over the temptation of casually asking a young Tibetan farmer whether he had ever heard of the Valley of Mystery. He looked at me in a very strange way and replied, me, footnote. But there was something in his whole attitude that made it seem probable for the attentive observer that he did know something about it but was reluctant to talk. The Valley of Mystery was less than 3 days' walk distant, and if there really was a city inhabited by many hundreds of people, it was improbable that he had never heard of its existence. Surely the Valley of Mystery must exist, I insisted, for I am going to it. Footnote. No L95 he gave a start and then observed, almost tremblingly, in a very low voice, of course, most of us know that the city exists, but it is an unwritten law that none of us should ever speak about it, or even mention its name. I know the way, I said, once more examining Nabu's sketch drawn with the accuracy of an officer on a Western general staff. I do not want to make you talk, as I shall soon find out all about it myself. Tell me only why you are not allowed to talk, and who forces so many thousands of people to hold their tongues. Dreadful punishment comes automatically to all those who break this rule, he answered. We know this by experience. Last year, two friends of mine passed on some rumors they had heard about the city. They were both taken very ill the same evening, and all their cattle died. The same and even worse things happen to all those who try to get near the city out of curiosity. Did you ever try it? I asked. No, he replied, and this is the last question I can answer. I never went there, but a friend of mine tried it. He had passed the borderline marking the precincts of the city and returned some time later to join his friends who had accompanied him. He looked 3 years older and had become mute. He could not speak for 3 months. His footnote was paralyzed. I went on my way. Footnote tongue. I was not inclined to take the story very seriously, although the peasant had seemed greatly frightened. Once such fears get a firm hold of a whole population, autosuggestion becomes a mighty factor. Why should a powerful degree of autosuggestion not bring about disease and paralysis? I had found cases of this kind in other parts of the world. 2 days later I approached the city of the initiates. I was in the valley indicated in Narbu's sketch. At a place where it was about 100 yards wide, the river bed suddenly disappeared. Here stood a few large stone slabs displaying the word border chiseled into the stone in large characters. So this was the borderline footnote the Tibetan peasant had mentioned to me. I passed on. The valley beyond the stone slabs looked exactly like the area on the other side of it, with the difference that the riverbed had suddenly disappeared. I walked several hundred yards farther, but no city came in view. A few hundred yards farther on, the valley gradually widened, but still no city was visible. I began to wonder whether I had lost my way. When I had walked a few more minutes, I suddenly noticed a circular stone wall measuring about 4 feet in height and about 10 yards in diameter, erected in the middle of the valley where it was about 400 yards wide. The ground very gently sloped from that circular wall in all directions, and in a much wider circle the radius of footnote tam, which was perhaps 100 yards, there were 7 quadrangular railings. I approached. The nearer I came, the more I could see how tidy and remarkably well kept everything seemed to be. Then I noticed that the 7 railings enclosed 7 quadrangular patches of ground entirely, covered with large slabs made of glass. The area of each quadrangle was about 40 by 40 yards. In front of each quadrangle, a staircase led underground to a substantial door. It was obvious that the 7 quadrangles were so many residential buildings built into the ground, the light coming in through flat glass ceilings on a level with the ground. I at once realized the idea of the designer of these strange houses. It would be easy to keep them warm in the winter. At the same time, the city would be practically earthquake-proof, and as the roofs were on a level with the ground, it would be sufficient to cover the glass surfaces with sand and to remove the railings and the little wall in the center to make the whole city disappear in cases of emergency. In the worst event, even the staircases could be covered up. The light of the morning sun made the glass surfaces glitter, and I began to wonder how the inhabitants protected themselves from the scorching rays of the sun in the hot summer afternoons, when I noticed a large pipe leading up to a kind of tank in the circular wall in the center, which was situated at the highest point of the gently sloping plain. Smaller pipes ran out from the tank towards the glass surfaces, and it was probable that on hot afternoons the temperature of the houses could be kept down by a continual flow of water over the glass roofs. I went down one of the staircases and stood before a heavy door. There was no device at all by which a visitor could signal his presence. I knocked with my fingers and a little later with my fist, but no one came to open. I had the idea to get on the glass roofs and trample in order to wake somebody, but found that this was quite impossible as the railings were more than 8 feet high, very substantial, and so ingeniously devised that climbing over them was impossible. So all I could do was to stroll about, looking for someone. But nobody was abroad. I seemed to be in a city of the dead. And yet it was perhaps 9:30 in the morning. I decided to take a little walk to examine the neighborhood, hoping to meet someone on my return. I walked out of the city in the opposite direction, but once I was beyond the railings of the last glass surface I was again in the desert, and 1/4 mile farther on there were other stone slabs again displaying the word border. That was all I saw. I turned round to walk back. The city of the initiates lay before me at a distance of 100 yards, but had I come there for the first time unaware of its existence I should not have noticed it. The thin railings, which were exactly the same color as the ground, were hardly visible and the circular wall was hidden by a little ridge. When I had returned I saw somebody come up one of the 7 staircases. It was not necessary to call him. He came along to meet me with great rapidity. "Kyle, are you Doug?" [Footnote: He asked sharply. He wore a chupa made of cheap silk and was scrupulously clean. His eyes were very cold. There did not seem to be any expression in his face. "I have been invited to come here," I answered. "By whom?" His voice sounded almost hollow, and was impersonal in tone. I mentioned Narabu's name. His cold aloofness at once gave way to great respect. "It is too early, sir. Very few people in the city get up before noon. Life here begins in the early afternoon. If you have been invited to come here, Lamo Chunj will know about it. You must wait. Perhaps she will come out from the palace in an hour. TNCU't. What do you want here?" "F goddess. The palace, 1 inch," I exclaimed. "Yes, the palace," he repeated. "That is the palace." He pointed to one of the quadrangular glass surfaces. He bowed respectfully and passed on. During the whole conversation his eyes had remained quite aloof. I looked at him while he walked away. Another man dressed in cotton came up from another staircase. I did not like his gait at all. I could not help thinking of the doll in a well-known operetta by Offenbach. There was no life about this man, not a shade of individuality. The coldest valet having lived for years with the coldest aristocrat in the world would be a volcano of life and feeling in comparison with this man. When he passed me I got a glimpse of his eyes. They were almost glassy, like the eyes of a corpse. To use my time I once more examined everything very carefully. I had not yet explored the wall and leaned over it. It was built round a vertical shaft. I looked down. It seemed to be enormously deep. I strained my eyes. Down it went, and seemed to disappear in the bowels of the earth. I looked for a stone. If I threw down a good-sized stone about 10 pounds in weight I could ascertain its depth, I thought. The city was so tidy that not a single stone covered the ground. I had to walk at least 5 minutes to fetch a few good-sized stones. I threw one of them down into the shaft and listened. 10 seconds passed and there was no sound. 20, 30, 40, 50 seconds passed and yet no sound came. One I threw down a second heavy stone and leaned over the wall. There was no sound at all. One I walked towards the mountainside a second time and fetched a big stone weighing at least 20 pounds. I pulled out my rubber boat from the bag made of sheepskin in which it was hidden and with the help of strings and safety pins turned it into a large earphone. Fastening it to the wall of the shaft, the wide opening turned downward. I then threw down the heavy stone and listened through the earphone with the greatest attention. 10 seconds passed, then 20, then 30. I no sound yet. One I was in the greatest suspense. After about 35 seconds I heard the sound of the heavy stone as it savagely tore along the wall of the shaft. The brushing against the wall continued for several seconds. But by the 40th second it had not yet struck the bottom. I listened through my earphone for another minute but did not hear the faintest sound. Surely this was an interesting object of study for any explorer, and I walked once more to the mountainside and returned with a piece of rock weighing a little over 30 pounds. At that moment another Tibetan ran up to me from one of the staircases, saying, "My lord, our guest, you are respectfully requested not to throw stones into the shaft." He looked at me icily with his glassy eyes and walked away. Soon afterwards the city seemed to awaken to life. People came up the various staircases, most of them humbly dressed in cotton gowns. A few others were dressed in silk. The inhabitants seemed to belong to two different categories. Those dressed in silk moved about like human beings,